Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. It feels a little bit weird to do this again in our normal manner, you know, back at home. We're not doing this in front of a live audience. It's great.
Yeah, it's great. It's just me and you, like old times.
Like old times. We missed the old times, although it's been really fun. So I don't know if the ASHT episode is going to drop in time to supersede this one. It probably won't because we're still waiting on the audio, but that was an incredible meeting. So the Hand Therapy Society was in St. Louis this past weekend, and it was a great meeting, lots of energy, and it was really fun to do a live taping of the podcast.
Yeah, it looked like fun. I was away at my daughter's parents' weekend. She's a first year in college, and it was important for me to be there, and I was so happy to be there, but I carved out time, and you thankfully were present on site. I was present by Zoom. It was super fun, and it did look like the energy was great, and people were asking questions. It was awesome.
I think it was fantastic. I truly enjoyed it. It gave me a lot of, it was very humbling, you know, to be asked to do something like that. And it gave me a lot of fulfillment to just be up there and kind of talk. And I heard that there were people in the audience who, really got into it. And they said that this is what we've been needing, to have just surgeons really speaking their minds, maybe with or without any preparation.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason you and I enjoy this is that we are, you know, just talking about how we think about things, you know, with good scientific basis, but having those conversations with our colleagues in different fields and at different levels of training does feel good. It's super fun to interact with therapists and students and residents and the whole thing.
Shout out to Dean Becky. She was our guest and our moderator, I guess, for the session. And she did a great job mixing right in with us. Those of you that are listening will hear it next week. But I believe she used to work with you in the office. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. Becky and I have known each other for a long time. I'm sorry I didn't get to see her in person. She was in St. Louis at WashU I guess it was just Millikan Hand Therapy then. And yeah, we worked closely together before she left to go north. And then now she headed east for Elon, where she is a dean of health sciences. It's pretty awesome. I love her path.
It is pretty impressive. And I'm sure it was a nice coming home for her, because I know that she also mentored and advised one of my dear therapy colleagues, Jamie Findice, who was her student at Maryville. They called her Dr. Becky at the time.
It's kind of awesome. So I want to give you a shout out, a well-deserved shout out. So I think the listeners understand how your career is, you know, going so incredibly well. Clinically, you've established yourself as a nerve expert, well-deserved. I think you are a good thinker, and you share your thoughts eloquently. You've written great stuff. You are funded at the highest level. So that's all great, and it's reflected in your promotion. So congratulations. So now you are an associate professor, but what's really important, and some of you may be rolling your eyes like, who cares? It matters. I care. It's really tough for a clinician to get promoted on the tenure track. Really tough. And so you have accomplished that in a time where for orthopedic surgeons to accomplish that goal, it's hard. And I'm really happy for you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You even managed to say good things about nerve surgery at the same time. I appreciate that. Yeah, it feels good. It's one of those things where I'd been thinking about it for quite some time. And I'll be honest with you, the tenure track stuff was a bit trying. It obviously made it more challenging to achieve that bar. But I'm very proud of it. Now, you know, I was asked to give a talk at the clinician scientist program for the Orthopedic Research Society. And the talk they asked me to give was on promotion and tenure. And I don't know if they knew that I had just been promoted at the time they asked me to give the talk. And I don't think they knew whether I was on the tenure track or not. But I did a lot of research into what tenure means in 2021 at academic medical centers and in surgical departments. And the answer is that it's highly variable. It's It's, I don't know. To me, it feels good. I don't know what it does for me outside of that, but I do like the badge of honor. Perhaps I've been conditioned that way, but I do like it. And so I got the letter of tenure when we were at the Hand Society on that Friday. So when I shared it with my family, I came home and my kids had made signs saying congratulations, and it was great. And then I asked my son. I said, he's six, and I said, Rocky, well, what are you congratulating me for? He said, you know, because you got your 10 thing. And I'm like, what? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, it's got to be good because it has 10 in it. I'm like, all right, perfect. And then I said, well, why do you think I got it? And he's like, because you're a really good teacher. I'm like, all right, I'll take that. That was probably one of the best definitions of the worth of tenure that I've heard.
He got it right. And it is interesting, again, for those not in academics, tenure in 2021 for a surgeon, honestly, you know, we think of tenure when we're talking about college professors and it's a big deal. It means their job is secure. Tenure for us doesn't really mean all that much. It doesn't necessarily change our job security, but it is absolutely important to the process. And so it means a lot. So congratulations and enjoy it.
Thank you. I will. And, you know, at our place that hopefully that's the biggest jump is from assistant to associate with tenure. And we'll see where it goes from there. You know, not all of us can be, you know, full professor with the Weiland medal hanging. Why aren't you wearing your Weiland medal? I want it hanging on your. So those of you that are watching on YouTube, Chuck is not wearing his Weiland medal, which is a shame because I actually, if I were you, I would get it made into like a WWF championship belt style.
True. That's a good idea. I may have to look into that.
Yeah, I'm sure the Hand Society provide funding for that. But anyway, why don't we jump in? You know, I think that there's a lot we could share, but you know, we really love getting listener feedback from our community. And everybody loves these deep dive episodes, the detail episodes. So you have another one a day. And everybody loves sports, apparently. So we're doing another deep dive on a sports thing. But we had a great email from, this is fantastic, Chuck, a consultant orthopedic and trauma surgeon in the Greek army. It's amazing. So Major Yanis Lakanas, thank you for your email. And he had a question here. So he says, in the deep dive episode about SL injury, you mentioned a hypothetical patient's x-rays show no SL widening, but maybe a bit of dorsiflexion of the lunate. But dorsiflexion of the lunate, independent of the scaphoid, should only happen once the two bones are completely separated and probably after all the secondary stabilizers have failed, right? So can there be a circumstance that one can see the radiographic appearance of DZ with a well-preserved relationship between the scaphoid and lunate in the coronal plane, you know, no gapping, in the absence of a scaphoid fracture or non-union? So Chuck, what do you think? I'm the one who gave you the case. I admit I have seen that, you know, so no widening, but some dorsiflexion. What do you think about that? And how can you explain it to me knowing that you're the expert here?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the question. And it is a good one, and it's not an easy one. Let's start by just saying, what are the radiographic parameters which are indicative of a complete SL tear with loss of secondary stabilizer? So just let's set the floor. So if you have that situation, you will see widening of the SL interval, classically more than 3 millimeters. You will see flexion of the scaphoid, classically more than 70 degrees. So scapholunate angle more than 70 degrees. And the other sign we talk about is the ring sign, which is seen on a PA radiograph, which indicates flexion of the scaphoid because you're catching the distal scaphoid or the tuberosity on FOSS. And so you get kind of a ring looking appearance. So those are the three classic signs. I agree that it's hard to explain dorsiflexion of the lunate in the setting of an intact SL, or at least partially intact SL, and intact secondary stabilizers. The tricky part, of course, is that the secondary stabilizers are really hard to understand. You know, we don't get information classically from radiographs about, say, the ST ligaments, the scaphotrapezial ligaments. We can get some information about the dorsal and volar contributions to scapholunate stability. But in all likelihood, in your case, there were secondary stabilizers which were compromised without a full tear of the SL. That would be my expectation.
Do you think that if you had compromise of some or many of the secondary stabilizers, with a tear of the dorsal and central portions of the SL, but you still had some volar fibers of the SL intact. Do you think that scenario could happen? And do you think that scenario could lead to the point where you're not maybe getting widening of the scaphoid and the lunate interval, but you're getting some of that rocking back of the lunate inflection of the scaphoid?
Yeah, well said. I kind of had a similar situation today. But yes, you get some rotation around the intact portion of the SL ligament. If that's volar, then that's exactly what you see. And that's very similar to what I saw today in the operating room, leading to a repair situation. So it's a good question. It's an important question. I have to say it's not fully understood, but that's the way you and I seem to think about this the same way, and that's how I think about it.
Now, Chuck, there's more. Major Giannis continues to ask us, also, what would be your preferred treatment of a chronic, maybe over 1 year, dorsal wrist pain patient with an unremarkable exam and the MRI shows a possible tear of the membranous SL? Assuming all non-operative portions have failed, would you scope? And if you did scope, what would you do with this portion of the ligament? Now, before I let you answer this, you have taught me a lot about kind of this nebulous and nagging pain that could be related to a volar SL or, like Giannis was saying, a membranous tear. And I don't think there's a great solution, but again, you're the genius in this area. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think that is high praise. In fact, too high of praise. I would say this: if all conservative treatment has failed, I do believe a wrist arthroscopy is logical. You know, the problem with open treatment of something like this is if your dorsal and volar ligaments intact, you know, what are you really going to do open? Plus, you risk destabilizing. Even a ligament sparing approach, I do think, compromises some of those secondary stabilizers like the DIC, the dorsal intercarpal ligament, and potentially the dorsal radiocarpal ligament. So a scope has minimal negatives and a lot of potential positives. And the way I've thought about it is that debridement of that area can take care of the pain, which is part of it. And I don't hesitate, and this is highly controversial. There is literature support for it for sure. Peter Weiss has written about this amongst others, but heat shrinkage of that.
I knew you were going to talk about that thermal shrinkage,
but it's a very limited thing. And I think part of it is just the, you're cleaning up the fibers because you don't need that membranous portion. If your dorsal volar intact, if you're stable, I don't know what exactly we're accomplishing, but it feels good to be doing something.
So do you just like make a portal and put the Bovie in and just turn it up to like 100 and just zap that thing? Like, what do you do exactly?
That's kind of what we do. It's like we handle nerves. Like when we do a carpal tunnel, we just buzz the nerve if it starts acting funny.
Oh man. Every time I watch our residents do the dissection, and shout out to Paul Inklin. He took the challenge, the gauntlet that we threw down about the old school resident dissection, and really took it to another level with his dissection this week. So thank you, Paul. But every time I see one of our residents moving around a nerve in a cadaver, just grabbing it with the forceps, not to say you did this, Paul, others have, it just, I get a little chest pain. So you're striking a nerve here, no pun intended.
Yeah, there is a little refinement of the technique, but there's a small joint wand or probe that you can selectively and under a significant irrigation apply heat to that membranous portion of the SL. Does it add anything beyond a debridement? Honestly, I don't know. But it has been effective in my hands with certain patients. It's a pretty rare scenario where you can't get a patient better with just a membranous tear, but it does happen.
Well, Major Giannis, I hope that Chuck has answered your question adequately. Please let us know if he hasn't. And shout out to everybody who has sent us emails. We love the listener mailbag. So handpodcast@gmail.com. We have a few emails in the queue to read. Lots of questions. Sandra Stiller, Josh Hustet, Bob Vandermark, and Brittany Mitchell, you're coming up soon. We may just have to have like a fan mail episode for where we answer all these questions.
Well, I think that's when you hit the big time, you have a mailbag, and some of the sports podcasts I occasionally listen to have that. That would be fun. Be totally fun. I have two comments. The first comment is,
of course, two things. Classic.
Yes, two things. Not one, not three, two. Please sign up for our newsletter, which is impending. And so if you go to any of the podcast show notes, there's an easy link to follow. We would love for you to sign up, and Chris and I plan a newsletter, which hopefully will be fun and informative. That's number one, Chris. Number two is a question for you. What does the number 105,000 mean to you?
So that actually gave me a little bit of PTSD to a moment in fellowship where Dr. Gelbman wrote a bunch of numbers down, and he literally looked at me and said, "What do these numbers mean to you?" I'm going to guess that it is what you got when you got promoted from associate to full professor about 5-6 years ago. I don't know.
A bonus? No, there was no bonus with that.
So I don't have much to look forward to then?
No, financially? No.
Damn it.
The 105,000 is our current download number. So we are so thankful for all of you listeners. We have 105,000 plus downloads, which is really remarkable. So we are grateful and we are proud.
That is fantastic. So we love it. Thank you to everybody for listening. The outpouring of love for the podcast at the Hand Therapy meeting at the Hand Society was incredible. It continues to drive us. So thank you for listening. And of course, tell your friends. We're actually out of swag, which is incredible. It just went away quickly at the Hand Therapy meeting. And I do have a few that I have to send overseas to the surgeons in the UK who helped take care of our friend and partner, Dr. David Brogan, during his visiting fellowship. It's amazing. So thank you for listening. And we won't torture you longer before we drop into this episode. So let's talk about some deep dive and detail into thumb UCL.
All right. I love it. I love it. And I think it's a good topic. Because I do feel like, compared to 5 years ago, most of us, at least amongst our partners, think about this slightly differently. So let me give you a case, and we can talk through it. So let's take a 25-year-old who was playing kickball. And kickball is a dangerous sport. I think all the listeners know that. And often it's the 35-year-old who may have had a beverage or two. But kickball is usually on a crappy field. Kickball is dangerous. And so this kickball player was a little younger, and he was rounding first for a hopeful double, tripped, fell, and jammed his thumb into the turf. And his day job is accounting, and he's worried about typing. It's 10 days after his injury. He comes in. His thumb is still swollen. His thumb is sore, and you are concerned about a UCL. I know we don't want to get too much into the diagnostic process, but just tell me briefly how you think about it, and then let's jump to the next steps.
I mean, I clearly am going to take a good history and ask if he has a side gig as a gamekeeper, because clearly that's pertinent to positives and negatives. I'll also ask him if he likes to ski, because, you know, that's also pertinent in this situation. But in all seriousness, I think that point tenderness is big, and then it comes down on the physical exam to assessment of the integrity of the ulnar collateral ligament. Now, we're classically taught that there are two components of that ligament complex, the proper UCL and the accessory UCL. And in order to stress the proper, you should flex the MP joint down to about 30 degrees. And in order to stress the accessory, you do that in extension. And that's because that accessory tends to run as more of a horizontal ligament, as fibers at least, and the proper tends to run more obliquely. I always check a side-to-side exam. And I know that there is some variability even in asymptomatic patients side to side, but I do like to check a side to side so I can warn. Basically, I tell the patient, hey, this is what I'm going to do on your other side. I'm going to start here so I get a feel for what's going on. Now, I know that one of our former partners, Dr. Gellerman, did write a nice paper with Kathleen McKeon looking at whether you needed to stress in flexion and extension. And I believe his take home was, you know, really, you really just need to check an extension. But I tend to check in both. What do you think?
I tend to check in both as well. I tend to compare it to the opposite side. I try to do it all under C-arm. I just think it's an easier one-step process where you can actually better quantify. And we can talk a lot. Ryan Calfee has written a great paper looking at the kind of rotatory and translational instability which can accompany an ulnar collateral ligament tear of the MP joint. For simplicity, let me give you two facts. The first is that there is gross instability. There is no doubt that the UCL is ruptured. And he lets you examine him, although it hurts. And you are really concerned about the presence of a stenar lesion. So this is kind of your classic situation, acute rupture, seemingly from the base of the proximal phalanx, possibly with a stenar lesion, which would preclude healing even in a cast. And so you are planning to take this person to the operating room. Do you need an MRI?
Need? No. Would I get one? Maybe. And that's an honest answer. I think a lot of it depends on how confident I am on my exam. You're making this seem like it's an open and shut kind of situation. I'm assuming fluoroscopically, you see that radial translation of the proximal phalanx when you stress them. So I feel good about this. I'd probably tell them, look, you know, there are possibilities of false negatives with an MRI as well. Why don't we, if you think you want me to stabilize this for you as soon as possible, let's go for it. If you're having any hesitation about whether you want surgery or not, and you want to see if there's any capacity for healing with non-operative treatment, I actually think getting the MRI in that situation can be useful to help inform care and make sure, hey, look, there's no stentor. But an ultrasound can also do that for you if you're in the right place. What do you think?
I think that's well said. I think we probably overutilize MRI for this diagnosis in 2021, but I like the way you said it. You know, if you have a complete tear of the UCL without a stentor, if you cast this patient, it should heal. But it's just not quite as reliable as surgery, in my view. And obviously, if you have a stentor where that UCL is rolled up and precluded from reaching its attachment point by the adductor aponeurosis, then you really need to do surgery or you will remain unstable. So for this patient, I would not get an MRI and I would go to the operating room. So the facts are we have a young patient, 25, acute tear, and the question is, how do you do it? So let's talk through briefly.
Time out. Okay. Before you go on to this, I know that we're in a surgical detail episode, but for those of you that are less experienced, you know, Chuck, can you tell us, you know, I liken a stentor lesion to somebody snapping a window shade and the ligament rolling back behind the adductor aponeurosis. Now, I admit I am awful with analogies, but everybody seems to get that one. And then secondly, for those that are more junior listening, why does it matter to have a thumb UCL?
Yeah, and the thumb UCL is different than the thumb RCL or radial collateral ligament. If you can imagine, every time you pinch between the index and the thumb, you are stressing your thumb UCL. And without that, you can't obtain the same degree of pinch, even with secondary stabilizers. And so you will lose pinch strength and you will develop arthritis over time. And those are pretty factual statements. That I feel very comfortable with. So leaving it alone to me is not a great option. But to be very clear, that acute pain will go away. So the pain will get better. At 3 to 4 weeks, the patient will probably be feeling pretty good. But I would argue it's still not the right thing to leave them alone.
Okay. So say we've indicated this patient. What are you asking for when you book the case?
And that's one of the million-dollar questions. And so we know that this patient will do well with the repair. And we can talk about how to get there. But what I'm asking for is for most patients, I do more than simply put the ligament back down to bone. I use suture tape to supplement it. That adds cost. It doesn't really add time. But like many things we do in 2021, the recovery period is dramatically different with the suture tape versus without it. And so that's why I like it and use it most of the time, but not 100% of the time. Would you, in preparation for this, plan on suture tape? Or in a patient like this, is a simple repair good enough for you?
So I think that I've been now been spoiled by the suture tape. I think suture tape coming around, or if say I worked in an ASC where, you know, that wasn't available due to cost, my old approach would have been to put the ligament back down the bone, because you know in about 90% of the time it's off of the proximal phalanx. Put it back down the bone with a suture anchor of the mini type size. And I usually pin. And I would remove the pin at about 4 to 5 weeks. I'd leave it out of the skin and remove it in the office. And I was satisfied with that. It worked well. Granted, I'd only been in practice, I think probably four years before switching over to the suture tape. The big difference to me is that the suture tape makes me feel a little bit better about not pinning the joint and leaving that pin. Now, I don't know whether I could have just used an anchor and not pinned it. What was your practice prior to suture tape? Because some of our listeners may not have access to it or may not be familiar with it.
Yeah, the only time I have pinned is with a reconstruction, with a tendon graft reconstruction. I do not pin with a primary repair. So if I chose to treat this patient, if this patient was self-pay and didn't want the extra $1,000 or so for the suture tape, then I would simply repair it with a suture anchor. I wouldn't pin, but I would immobilize for 4 weeks probably before getting him moving. But the suture tape kind of removes a lot of those questions.
So from an approach perspective, you know, the way that I was taught was to make kind of a curve S-shaped incision, paralleling the course of the ligament along the ulnar side of the MP joint. I, of course, this is my favorite part of the case, dissect out the small cutaneous dorsal branch to the thumb and protect that. Now, I do warn patients ahead of time that they will feel numb on that portion of the thumb, even while we dissect it out and protect it. The traction on it and pushing it out of the way does cause some sensation disturbance, comes back. But I found out the hard way to warn people about that.
I think that's an excellent point. That's the first thing I do. Incise the skin, a little S-shaped incision centered at the MP joint. Find that cutaneous nerve. And you got to keep it safe, but it can be one of those classic situations where it gets irritated. Once I incise the adductor aponeurosis longitudinally, I put a little skin hook in the adductor aponeurosis dorsally, that dorsal limb, and it protects that cutaneous nerve during the rest of the procedure. But most people will be irritated or complain about a little numbness and it goes away. For some people, counterintuitively, some athletes, it can be bothersome to really to have that little area of numbness or tingling. Although again, it gets better as long as you protect the nerve.
You know, for the adductor aponeurosis, one tip that Marty Boyer, our partner, taught me when I was his fellow was to take the marking pen and put a purple mark on the adductor aponeurosis. And then I have then adapted it to blot it dry so it doesn't run. But I found that to be helpful to find that tissue layer to close back later. Perhaps you're just more gifted because you've got fancier loops than I.
I must have fancier loops. I don't feel the need to use a marking pen. And I think it generally presents itself, but you know, no qualms and certainly no harm in doing that. Before we incise the adductor, if there truly is a stenter lesion, so that collateral ligament is balled up proximally, everything looks a little confusing when you get in there. It's just that the clean, pristine anatomy is not there. But when you release that adductor, you kind of get a sense of, okay, I understand what's going on. Here's the stenter lesion, the balled up ligament. Here's the joint. Here's the insertion site. And you try to unfurl that that ligament and bring it back and make sure it reaches the base of the proximal phalanx.
I'll admit, you know, because I'm not typically the one holding the knife at that stage, I have the trainee incise the adductor in line with what I think the UCL fibers, the proper UCL fibers should be running, just in case, because sometimes we're not sure. So it makes me feel a little better. And as they're dissecting layer by layer, you start to see things declare itself a little bit better. You can clearly go more proximally on the metacarpal origin of the ligament, but it just becomes harder if it's truly curled up on itself to distinguish the anatomy.
I think that's well said. And you obviously want to protect the ligament. And then all of a sudden you're down at bone. So if you're just going to perform a suture anchor repair, there's not much to it. If I choose that approach, I put some type of mini suture anchor, doesn't really matter which one, honestly, into the base of the proximal phalanx. More volar than dorsal. Michelle Carlson has a good article about the exact specifications of where the footprint is, just off the articular surface. I personally like a little Krakow weave into the collateral ligament, bring it down the bone, and you're done. Is that how you approach it if it's a suture anchor repair?
Yeah, same way. I was actually in Michelle's lab when she was doing that paper. I didn't write that one, but I worked with her research coordinator, so I'm familiar with that paper. And you know, I believe the take home was it's about 3 millimeters dorsal from the volar lip of the proximal phalanx and 3 millimeters distal to the articular surface. And that was a really helpful paper for me to be able to localize that anatomy. Obviously you don't want to be too close to the joint, standard suture anchor kind of technique. And yeah, whatever suture pattern the ligament will give you. I have a question for you. One of my other mentors in residency would, in a setting of elbows, would say, if it's an acute tear of a ligament, no matter how long it's been, you should be able to repair that ligament back down. The ligament should still be of good quality. On the cases where you've gone in a little bit delayed, Have you found the ligament to be of reasonable quality to repair? And what triggers you to start thinking, ooh, maybe we need to do a reconstruction?
Yeah, you know, I guess 10 years ago, there was a lot of conversation of, you know, what happens if you're taking care of an athlete and there's 5 weeks left in the season and he or she thinks they can play through this and you want to repair them after the season, will there be enough collagen? Will there be a sufficient ligament to get that repair done? And the answer is, I don't know. I think at 5, 6, 7 weeks, you may be unsatisfied with the primary ligamentous repair. And so that's when I start thinking about a reconstruction. Or if there's reasonable collagen, but not perfect, I may accept putting the residual ligament down and supplementing with an internal brace. Really, it's about the amount of collagen there. And if there's just really nothing there, then I am not comfortable with an internal brace alone. I would add a palmaris longus or some type of tendon graft to supplement with an internal brace or suture tape.
Now, do you ever consider, I've never done this, but do you ever consider any of the dynamic reconstructions or dynamic stabilizations of the UCL if you can't do a primary repair of good collagen?
I haven't. So people talk about advancing the adductor. For me, no. I'll use palmaris and supplement it with a suture tape.
So say, for example, do you ever, when you're putting in your suture anchor for this and before you tie down your ligament, how are you doing this in terms of making sure the joint is reduced? Because we know not only the that the proximal phalanx wants to translate radially, there's this angular kind of gapping and perhaps, like you mentioned earlier, a little bit angular and sometimes some volar subluxation of P1 relative to the metacarpal head. When you're doing this, who's holding the reduction? Are you pinned? I'm assuming you're not based on what you're saying before, but who's holding it? Who's tying down the ligament?
So I think it's a great question. It's one of the pearls that I feel like has helped me a great deal is I do intraoperatively pin these patients. And so I obtain an anatomical reduction of the joint, perhaps slight over reduction, meaning the proximal phalanx is tilted a little bit in the ulnar direction. And I hold it with a K-wire, which I remove before leaving the OR. I have found it really difficult to manage a three-dimensional reduction while inserting the suture anchor and the suture tape. And I you can get it done for sure, but it usually takes more than two skilled sets of hands. You need three skilled sets of hands. And I think it's tough. So I've been really happy with the intraoperative pinning.
Oh, thank goodness I'm not the only one. I feel much better now. I pin it. I get the reduction. I do a little bit of overcorrection, checking all planes. And I pin it. It just makes my life a lot easier.
It does. And I think there's no harm to the joint. With a single, you should be able to place that pin on the first pass, and I consider it no harm whatsoever. I think the other pearl is how do you manage both repairing the ligament down to bone and putting your suture tape in. And so for me, and I'm interested in your thoughts, I try not to use the biggest anchor for the base of the proximal phalanx, but I put that anchor in first. It's loaded with suture tape and suture, and the joint is reduced and pinned. And so I have one limb of the suture, which is now secured with the suture tape at the base of the proximal phalanx. And I use that as a, crack eye weave or whatever to bring the ligament down. It's a little tricky with tensioning, and you got to kind of think about how it's going to sit as you place your sutures. And then I place my second anchor. Really it's that origin site. You want to be careful not to disrupt the origin of the ligament. So I usually go a little proximal, referring back to Michelle's paper, a little dorsal to the midline on the lateral view. And I check a C-arm for the placement of that K-wire. And once I'm happy with that, I drill and then I dunk the suture tape into the metacarpal just proximal to the origin of the collateral ligament.
I found the tensioning to be a little bit tricky with this particular implant. Just the anchor tends to handle differently upon insertion, and also running the suture through it can be tricky, although I've had plenty of cases where the tensioning works just fine. What I'd ask you is what size suture is in the anchor? Are you loading a 2.0 in there, a 3.0, something even more stout than a 2.0?
Generally, it's a 2.0. A 3.0, I think, is totally fine in this situation. I don't think you want to go any bigger. Really, your goal here is just to have the ligament reapproximated because it has the additional support of the suture tape. So you're not really worried about it maintain, you know, being sufficiently strong. I guess my other pearl would be as you place your suture tape, you don't want to over tighten this. That's an error. And so you can over tighten it. And so what I do is I apply a gentle force, and as I dunk the anchor into the bone, I let go of the suture tape. So I've applied some force and I'm holding the suture tape over the drill hole I've created. And then I dunk the anchor into bone without holding that suture tape. And it seems like that applies a good force and it avoids over tightening, but does provide sufficient support for the joint. If you over tighten, there's questions about stress shielding and whether the ligament will heal and whether you become too dependent on the suture tape, which can lead to later problems. So I've been happy, and I think that tensions things well.
Can you over-tension it even while you're pinned?
I think you can, because a single K-wire doesn't provide perfect stability. I think you can, but fair point.
No, I always have to remind our orthopedic trainees, we do also have plastic trained fellows as well, that you can break a 2-0 suture when you're trying to slide down your finger, and not to use the classic orthopedic thumb when running walking down your suture, but to use something a little more elegant like an index finger. But I have had those break, and I sigh very heavily in the operating room, tried to keep my composure, but it is not a fun day at the office when that happens.
Oh no, I totally agree with that.
And then one more thing before we go on. If for those of you that don't have access to suture tape, what was your pre-suture tape suture selection for that anchor?
Something like a 2-0 Ethabond. I still think that's sufficient because really we're going to protect that patient in a cast. I used to, when I first started, I did it for 6 weeks. I think that is not necessary. I protect them in a cast for 4 weeks and then I get them moving.
So no, if there's no suture tape, pin across the joint, single 4-5 or 6-2 wire.
Doesn't matter. For me, it's just intraoperative. I'm taking it out before they leave the OR.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Gotcha. So in the OR, what are you using?
4-5 usually.
4-5. Okay. And then if there's no suture tape, you are then immobilizing them for 4 weeks?
4 weeks and then get them moving with therapy. One other technical pearl, which I should have mentioned, when I pin the joint, I mentioned slight over reduction, but concentric reduction of the joint. I do tend to put the joint in about 20 degrees of flexion when I'm pinning it to avoid losing flexion as they heal. So you don't want to over tighten an extension because that's a problem. And I've seen that happen. I've been guilty of that, I'm sure. So that's another technical pearl. So slight over reduction, slight flexion, concentric joint reduction.
Now, do we make too much? I mean, I always thought it was a big deal to make sure that the proximal phalanx wasn't volarly subluxating. Have you seen that to be much of an issue when you're trying to position these for pins, or usually not a problem?
I haven't seen it be a major problem, no. So I repair the adductor aponeurosis, close the skin, protecting your nerve, Chris, the Chris nerve. Mm-hmm. I splint, I have MC therapy within 1 week, a removable hand-based splint, get them moving. And the beauty of this for the athlete is this injury used to cost 12 weeks for sports. And while I get nervous, I think you can have people playing full contact, full bore at 6 weeks, ideally with a little protective splint. The wonderful example is Steve Shen's patient, Mike Trout, was back playing in the minors at 5 weeks, playing in the majors at 6 weeks. Drew Brees as well. Unbelievable. Again, I like a little custom splint that doesn't get in the functional way. But that's remarkable. And, 6 weeks to you and I would hurt, if we couldn't operate. 6 weeks to a professional athlete, the difference between 6 and 12 weeks of getting back to play is a big deal.
So when you talk about getting them moving, now those of you watching on YouTube saw that video of Chuck kind of flexing down, flexing his MP joint. When do you allow them to pinch?
I think I go slow. Or I go slowly to be grammatically correct. They are moving in the plane of motion, and we're working on edema control and basically just letting them be. Basically, I tend to hold pinch for 5 or 6 weeks. Obviously, you probably don't need to do that given the support of the internal brace. But the question is why? Why push it in most patients? Maybe in an athlete struggling to get back, maybe you do it at 4 weeks, but I don't start that right away.
Are there any markers you use to know when the patient is ready to graduate from, you know, pinch free, but moving into plane of the palm to when they can start to pinch? Is it when they have full motion or is it purely a time thing, 5-6 weeks?
It's purely a time thing. I don't think there's any great criteria. I always talk to athletes about requiring three things before return to play. One is full motion, second is full strength, and third is no pain. These patients don't have pain, from the second week. So that's off the table. They don't really check their strength super early. So it's really about getting that motion back first. And then when do we have confidence to let them go? And certainly by 6 weeks, we have confidence because not only is the ligament probably healed, you still have the internal brace and maybe a bit earlier.
And maybe to milk one more technical detail out of you, absorbable suture or nylon suture?
For the skin, obviously. I know we talk a lot about this and I am routinely disappointed with absorbable sutures. I really like the scar. I like the simplicity of nylons. Now, in a younger patient, where you don't want to take stitches out, that's a different thing. But in an adult, I typically use nylons here. You?
It's interesting. I will use, in this particular scenario, an absorbable suture and have not had any issues with it. But in a different location, for example, the other day I was operating on the opposite side of somebody who had a carpal tunnel lacertus. And typically when I do a carpal tunnel, I pretty much always do nylon sutures. And if for the lacertus, the proximal median nerve decompression in the forearm, I will use an absorbable monocryl. He didn't like the way that looked. He had a little reaction to it still where the suture was exiting out. He clearly hadn't absorbed it in time. And when I went back to do his opposite side, I tend to look side to side and make sure my incisions are going to be reasonably the same length for my obsessive New York tendencies that I developed in residency. And he's like, yeah, I don't like this. Can you just use the the nylon suture? Like, sure, happy to, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always, you get burned once with some railroad track appearance of the suture holes or the looking ugly, and you wonder, should I be switching and doing subcutaneous and subcuticulars? I don't know. I just find complications, even if they're little complications, complications are less with nylon sutures.
All it takes is one patient.
All right.
So any other great technical pearls you want to share? Or are we out of Gofar pearls for thumb UCL?
I think I'm done. I think you now know everything I know.
Data dump complete. So yes. All right. Well, next. So everybody, handpodcast@gmail.com. Let's get the next deep dive topic request. I'm sure it's going to be another sportsy thing. So I'll have to figure out what to do for that. But send us your suggestions, social media as well, Hand Podcast on Twitter. So look us up or leave it in a review. We would love to hear some questions in reviews. Ask Chuck anything, literally anything.
Literally anything. And so we have some good episodes coming up. We're going to share the flexor tendon discussion from the ASHT, I hope. You and I have talked about doing a social media discussion about impact in the academic world and kind of profile building, which I think will be super fun. We have a lot of cool topics coming up.
Yeah, and we have to get Jeff and Steve back, our recurring guests that we haven't had back. I think it's time. They had a great symposium at the Hand Society called Free Solo. So we're looking forward to hearing how that went.
Absolutely. That sounds fantastic. All right. Well, it's fun catching up on a Wednesday night. I hope you have a good one, and I'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter @HandPodcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is @ congenitalhand. What about you?
Mine is @ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.